It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Ce qui se passe dans les bois est un véritable podcast sur la criminalité. Nous discutons d'événements qui sont souvent de nature violente. La discrétion de l'auditeur est conseillée.
What Happens in the Woods is a true crime podcast. We discuss events that are often violent in nature. Listener's discretion is advised.
Well, look who's back at it again. Welcome back, campers, to season 6 of What Happens in the Woods podcast. Bryce and I are back in the game, so to speak, and we're back with all the regular season cases. Hey, Bryce.
Hello.
You ready to do this?
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Feels brand new.
Yes.
We're in a different setup again. Testing the waters.
Yeah.
It's been good. I know you're sad it's not what the fucks.
Mm-hmm. They'll come back.
They will come back, yeah. There are some changes on the horizon. We've been kind of brainstorming and looking at ways to make changes of how we go about doing things. And we hope that you guys are going to be excited with some things that are coming your way. But for now, we're going to stick to the familiar things, and that is a crime based in the Pacific Northwest. Are you ready to get into it?
Let's do it.
Let's do it. I have mentioned, maybe just a time or two, that I cannot get enough of old-timey crime, so that's what we've got today. I've got a case that takes us back to the early 1900s in Oregon, and I'm excited to finally be talking about this religious group that some would maybe call a cult.
Yeah.
It's known as the Church of the Brides of Christ.
Okay.
And I think this might be a first for us. Have we discussed a cult before?
I don't think so.
I don't think so either. I'm sure that everyone's heard of this term called holy rollers.
Yeah.
Yeah. In relation to like certain religious groups. And I think we mainly use the term to reference like nowadays it's like Pentecostal churches where they, you know, practice speaking in tongues and all the, it's very energetic worship. Yeah. Church services can get very lively if you want
to say the least. That.
Yeah. They, you know, they kind of do the rolling in the aisles and the dancing and it's almost hazardous. You know, it's dangerous.
It's borderline mosh pit.
It kind of, I mean, really.
But you always had that one dude that wants to turn it into a mosh pit.
Yeah, no, I've seen, I've witnessed people like running into each other and like hitting walls and I've seen it with my own eyes. It's very enthusiastic.
Sure.
Yeah. They kind of, you know, they get wild for the Holy Spirit. It's really just overtakes you.
Yes.
Yeah.
If the Spirit moves you.
Yeah. There's different ways of worshiping different things. It's, you know, whatever floats your boat. Oh. It is hard to believe that in 1903 in the wilds of Oregon, there started a religious cult that had the tiny and tight-knit community of Corvallis ready to take vigilantism. That's a hard word. Vigilantism.
Words are hard.
Words are hard. Into their own hands. And this religion was headed by a man by the name of Franz Edmund Crayfield.
Okay.
It's a name, yeah. Crayfield has been described as quote-unquote homely, but he was charismatic. He had a way about him that led him to being able to lead people, and particularly women, to follow him and his, you know, views on religion.
I mean, you have to be charismatic.
Right.
Nobody wants a boring leader.
No, obviously. And there's, like, you know, there's nothing new in that, right? That's kind of the age old, even if it's a woman who's leading a group.
Yeah.
The charisma has to be there. You have to be able to get people to see your point of view and follow your ideas that might be slightly out of the norm or different from what is considered normal. He was described in one article I read as magnetic, quote unquote, having power over people or putting people under a spell. He was possibly also a hypnotist. So I guess he had taken a class or some courses at the time and studied mental telepathy, which at this time was very
new.
It was a new study, but it was kind of looked at with some mysticism. Mm-hmm. You know, it wasn't just how do you read people. Which now we know it's not really anything otherworldly, or you know, you don't have psychic powers, anything like that. You're really just reading people. Hypnotism can have its place in time, I think, in helping people with some habits, mm-hmm. but it very much, I think, has a science behind it. It's not, you know, back where in the 1900s or the late 1800s, it was kind of considered like a sixth sense type of thing.
There is a science behind it.
Yeah.
It's called NLP.
Oh, you even know the name of this?
Neuro-linguistic programming.
Oh.
It's one of my favorite magicians, Darren Brown. He has that show called Push.
Mm.
And it's on Netflix. It's a very fascinating look into human psychology, or social pressures.
Mm-hmm.
Because of social media and, you know, the groups have always been there. But NLP has always been fascinating to me. It's like how you can get someone to do it with just social pressure and the way that you say certain things.
Mm-hmm.
And he has this fascinating thing where he gives this guy paper money and he says, no, take it. It's fine. It's fine. And he buys a watch with it, or he buys some jewelry with it.
Mm-hmm.
And the guy takes it and even gives him change and he counts it back to him. It's the craziest thing. But In the show Push, he gets someone to actually push someone off a ledge.
Oh my God.
Yeah. It's a very interesting, and it's not just like he's a killer or this person's just a killer. It's
off a ledge where? Like off of a building?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'm sorry. And this person.
No, I don't want to spoil it, but it's an excellent program and like, you know, social engineering and I don't want to spoil the ending.
Okay. You just said somebody got pushed off a ledge though.
The whole premise of the show was like push.
Oh wow.
To see if they could get an ordinary person just to push someone off the ledge.
Was anyone harmed?
No. So the person is, I will let you know that the person, if they get pushed, they're hooked to a harness that you can't see.
Oh, okay.
And so if they do get pushed, they'll fall, but not maybe like 12 feet and they're on a harness.
Oh my God.
And it's actually, Darren Brown who's on the harness, the magician.
Oh.
Anyway, interesting. Neuro-linguistic programming.
That is, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. I didn't really, I mean, I knew that there was a word, there was words, there was a, there the was words. Yeah. I knew that there was, you know, that it had some kind of title, I guess you would say. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. They also teach it to you in the Air Force. Anyway.
Oh, okay.
Well, knowing you have to go through survival school and.
Yeah.
Like if you get captured. Yeah. Anyway.
Right.
I read more about it.
Okay. That's, well, there you go. Do I even need to continue? I don't know.
Yes.
All right. Well, back to Edmund, as he was known as.
That was France.
Well, that was his first name.
France.
Yeah, he didn't. He went by Edmund Crayfield at this point. He immigrated from Germany in the 1880s. There's really no backstory to him. There's really no research that I have found. I'm sure that there's a way to do some research on him, but I have not, because some of this information was a lot. There's a lot of detail that I had to condense because there's a lot of source information to go through. So I don't know when he was born, how old he was at this time. I don't really have any of that information. And the accounts are not clear for him, like the early years that he was in the U.S., but at some point he joined a Christian organization known as the Salvation Army.
Okay.
Which is still around today.
Yeah.
This was around 1890s. And in 1899, he moved to Portland, Oregon.
Okay.
And that he was going around in that area and going out with the Salvation Army. He was a soldier in the Salvation Army. So the Salvation Army is they fashion themselves in like a military hierarchy. Mm-hmm. So if you are just a member of the church, you are, and they, I don't believe at that time they baptized either, but you are indoctrinated, basically. You know, pledge that you're a member of the church, so you become a soldier. If you are like a minister, you start as a lieutenant, and then you work your way up, captain, major, and all of that. So that would be like the ministers, the people who are actually doing the preaching and the coordination of things, and then just the congregation would be a soldier. So he was a soldier in the Salvation Army during this time. Soon after, though, he parted his ways with the group. He still was, you know, preaching, but at this time he was just kind of on his own. He had a little bit of a clash of viewpoints with regard to some of the things that the Salvation Army would do. He in particular had an issue with like soliciting for money. So at this time, you know, the Salvation Army would go out and they would do open air meetings, and they would do things like ice cream socials. They would do, you know, open things in parks, and they would, you know, minister to people out in the public, but then they would take whatever money they raised and they would help, you know, feed homeless. They would have like soup kitchens, things like that. So he really didn't feel like soliciting for money was the right thing to do.
No.
And he had some issues with that.
So just take it then?
That's the thing is he really wasn't, from nothing that I can see, was he ever like, I need money.
Oh, okay.
Only in regard to the well-being of where they could, you know, the group that he goes on to form could live. They could have a place to live. That was really the only time that he had a materialistic goal in mind.
Okay.
In an interview with a reporter, he is quoted as stating, quote, "While in the Salvation Army, I had the light, but I did not have the power. I was teaching his works, but was still in the darkness. I did not experience the full of his power until I had tarried long before God in prayer. Then the light came. The Holy Ghost told me that I should live a life of pure faith. I was told to do everything by faith. I could no longer work for the army because its people are not entirely of God. I could not take part in soliciting for funds. I was directed by the Holy Ghost not to solicit for money." End quote. So he really felt very convicted that doing that, for whatever reason, I mean, I don't know whether that money was going to the purpose that it needed to be or not, you know, but he just felt convicted that he should not be doing that.
Okay.
Creffield visited areas where he administered for the Salvation Army before, and he began spreading his own radical views in the homes of town members. In one article I read, after parting ways with the Salvation Army, he retreated into the woods. He came out a few days later sporting a long beard, and it was of the true Moses type, quote unquote, flowing down his chest and spreading to the right and the left, unruly and wild. This is one description given. He was transformed in the woods into a prophet. He was, quote, a spokesman for Jehovah.
Okay.
Yeah. Came out with a booming voice and new ideas. So apparently he was a very soft-spoken, kind of mild-mannered man before this transformation in the woods. So he kind of, you know, became this new man. Well, a new man needs a new name. So he decided to start calling himself Josiah II.
Okay.
Yeah. He arrived in Corvallis not long after that. So this is a small town that's south of Portland. And this is in 1903, where he began to preach that he was enlightened in the knowledge of God and the Holy Spirit. Soon there were around a dozen followers in this very small community, mainly all farmers. Not a large, you know, city dwelling. These were hardworking people.
Yeah.
And they began to attend his holy roller meetings. He claimed that he was shown visions while deep in prayer, and he was given messages. And soon he was conducting in-home prayer sessions that would last for hours, if not days. His followers would scream and cry, yelling prayers to God. They would roll all over the floor, and they would wash away their sins with the rolling.
How would you wash?
Okay. I don't know. At the beginning of his new religious following, his sect included both men and women in the community. At some point, that slowly changed as the men kind of stopped showing up to his prayer meetings, and the followers that stayed were mostly women. And I think this is mainly not because the men were not following his ideals necessarily. It was that these meetings became more, they were held at times where the men would be away working.
Okay.
And I think that was intentional.
But
who knows? So in these homes where they would have these meetings, the shades would be drawn and the meetings would be more private. An account of one such meeting described Creffield leading the group to chant, quote, swaying with the rhythm, waving his arms, and calling for the full spirit to descend upon the meeting. And then they were naked.
Okay.
And that's why the women stayed and the men probably left, was because it was engineered that way. Who doesn't want to be alone in a room full of naked women?
Gay guys?
Yeah, but obviously he's not homosexual in any way, so. No. The group began to roll around, Creffield and a man who stayed a follower by the name of Brother Brooks, as well as all the females in the meeting, were all moaning, screaming, yelling. This went on for hours during this meeting.
Okay.
And this is an account given in a newspaper. His meetings were so disruptive to the community that city officials told him and the group that they had to knock this shit off and they had to move on. They had to get out of town. They could not have these meetings. They couldn't prove that there was anything illegal going on.
Yeah.
But it was disruptive. So they left. I doubt that there was anything that I think that if they could have made an arrest at that time, that they would have.
Yeah.
But he and the group relocated to an island outside of Corvallis. It is referred to as Smith Island or Robinson's Island. I'm not sure where the confusion is. I also saw it referred to as Kiger Island. And again, I really couldn't.
How do you spell
K-I-E-G-E-R.
Okay.
The meetings continued day in, day out. The members were convinced that Crayfield was a prophet and that they were told to sell their possessions, leave their families, give up their worldly lifestyle, and lead a life in purity. Again, he didn't take any of that money.
No.
No. I mean, they all lived equally, but they were told to give up their worldly possessions.
Okay.
Not that the money went for anything other than to probably feed and house them. It was at one of these types of meetings that Crayfield announced that he was to father the second Messiah, and the lucky lady was one of his followers.
Of course.
Yeah. These ladies were soon being called, quote, the Brides of Christ. The group was so disconnected from the townspeople and their relatives that they solely began to rely on each other and close themselves off to any outsiders. The group seemed to wholeheartedly believe that Josiah was being directed by God, and they did not disagree with any of the direction that he gave, believing that they would be damned to hell if they did not. So as you may expect, even though Crayfield and his followers were removed from town life, that didn't mean that they weren't the topic of discussion and gossip. If anything, it was even more talked about.
Okay.
Especially since the females, both young and old, were disappearing from their homes to go join this religious group outside of town. The local newspaper began reporting on how Crayfield was, quote, leading women, girls, and others into delusions and unnatural conditions. It was hot gossip that the women were, quote, freely running around and abandoning their husbands, fathers, and brothers, end quote. On one side, I obviously this guy is just kind of weird.
Yeah.
I mean, whatever. I think from the descriptions, we can all agree upon that. He had some interesting ideas. On the other side of it, you know, these women are trying to... is a little excitement in their otherwise
mundane life
of, you know, farming or town life.
Yeah.
And let's face it, they didn't have very many rights or any rights and little freedom to do what they wanted to do. So here's this guy saying, come follow me. We'll worship God. We'll be naked and we'll have fun.
Yeah.
Why not?
Why not?
I don't know. What the fuck not? In the cooler months at the end of 1903, life on the island was less than ideal, so Crayfield and the Brides moved themselves to the home of Corvallis local O.P. Hurt. And I've seen it in some of the articles. A lot of these articles are very hard to navigate through because there was no filter on the media back in the day. They could basically just say whatever the fuck they wanted, and it was just taken as fact, because it was there in the black and white of the paper, right?
Truth be damned.
Right. So I've seen it O-V as in Victor and O-P as in Paul. Paul seemed to be the most, like P as in Paul, it seemed to be the most used. So I'm going to stick with O-P, Hurt. So his family members were caught up in the Brides of Christ, and they had originated as a family who went to the Salvation Army, who was members of the Salvation Army Church, but the females stuck with Crayfield and they joined his little sect that he had going on. So they had run away from home basically to go join this, but then they ended up, you know, hey, everybody, let's go back to my house and we'll resume there for the winter. So there was a sign promptly posted above the door of the Hurt home that stated, quote, positively no admittance except on God's business. So, yeah, very interesting. The religious group was carrying on as usual with the hours of long prayer meetings, rolling around in the nude, all the other fun they had been having. Eventually, Hurt realized that allowing this into his home was maybe a little more than he bargained for.
Yeah. He's having second thoughts.
Maybe.
Buyer's remorse?
Yeah, a little bit, maybe. The group was told, so there was some rules Crayfield set, you know, down to everybody. He took charge of the house, which, you know, if you're used to being the man of the house and being listened to, you're gonna take too kindly to this long-bearded hippie guy coming in your home and saying, nope, I run the house now, you know? And have everybody listen to you,
yeah.
You know? So the group slept in one room on the floor. They were all nearly naked most of the time. Mm-hmm. Hearst's possessions were taken from the home, and some of them were even burned. There was a huge bonfire that was started to burn, like, belongings, furniture, stuff. People from all over came to see this bonfire and the spectacle that was happening at the Hearst home. There were also some orgies that were kind of getting out of hand, and it was reported, of course, who knows how likely this is, that the noise was heard a quarter of a mile down the road. That's some orgy.
Yep.
You know, you're not even, it's not even like you've got a stereo system and some bass.
Yeah.
You're just making that noise, you know, organically. That noise is happening. It was just enough, and the men of the town decided to take matters into their own hands.
Uh-oh.
Yeah. At some point, Crayfield and Brother Books were taken in for competency hearings at the courthouse. They were both found to be of sound mind, if not just a little creepy.
Yeah.
But there was nothing that pointed to, like, insanity or anything that was illegal. Mm-hmm. While the courts could not bring anything to an end legally, the law officers advised that the men should remove themselves from town. Mr. Hearst decided his patience was at an end with this group, and he kicked them all out of his home.
Okay.
A temporary home was rented for the group by Hearst's son, Frank, who was a follower, but, you know, he wasn't as caught up in all this that the women were caught up in.
Yeah.
And he managed to secure a house temporarily that was rented for the group at the edge of town. It was about this time that a still photo was circulating around that showed Crayfield in a field with a group of women, all in some sort of undress, laying or standing around him. And if you can imagine that, everybody lost their shit. I mean, everybody lost their shit, because here is black and white proof that somebody's wife, somebody's daughter, mm-hmm. is cohorting with this dude out in nature.
Mm-hmm.
Naked. God only knows what's happening. Yeah. And if that's your wife, you're maybe not so happy about it. It doesn't matter if it's for God or not. You might be a little upset.
But it's for God.
It's for God, but I don't know that. Yeah, I don't think that's a reason. The women and their girls were then kind of carted off from their messiah. They were sent to live in other parts of the United States or the state, being sent to institutions and sanitariums to have their behavior corrected. So these things came to a quick end in this case. And when we come back from this break, we'll learn how all of this ends for Edmund Crayfield and his Brides of Christ.
Boo.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, we're here.
We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
On January 4th, 1904, a mob of men showed up at the rented home where Crayfield and Brother Brooks were lodging. The men were forced by the mob to the edge of town of Corvallis, where they were promptly tarred and feathered and ran out of town. Yeah. Brooks took this message to heart, and he did not return.
No.
Edmund Crayfield didn't pay any heed to it. Crayfield was found hiding in the woods by Mrs. Hearst and her daughter, Maud. The ladies brought the man, still covered in tar and feathers, back to their home, cleaned him up. And what do you think they all thought would be a good idea to do to get, you know, Crayfield back into the good graces of the community?
Make him the mayor.
No. They planned a wedding. So he and Maud were married just days later.
Oh.
Mm-hmm.
Wait. Wasn't she married?
No, she was not. Maud was Hearst's daughter.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. The community was resigned to the fact that Crayfield wasn't going anywhere anytime soon, but there was hope that he would calm his shit down, mm-hmm. and that the orgies would at least stop, since he was now married to a woman from, you know, a very respected family. Apparently, Maud was not to be the mother of the second Christ, though. So the search was still on. And Caulfield left his new wife to seek out a former member of the Brides of Christ who was living with her husband in Portland.
Okay.
The two were caught in action by her husband, who quickly filed a complaint of adultery against the two. So this is kind of exactly what, you know, the authorities were looking for, was something legally that they could take action against him. Caulfield hightailed it out of town, promptly disappeared. A reward was posted, but I found conflicting amounts in news articles. So one said it was for $150. Mm-hmm. Another one said $350. This was posted by none other than his father-in-law, the former father-in-law, as Maud quickly filed for divorce. So 3 months go by. There's no sign of this guy.
Okay.
So the town of Corvallis and the surrounding areas, they just kind of, these people, they're thinking, okay, well, we're finally rid of this guy. The holy rollers, his religious, you know, thing, it's gone. It's had its day. Must be gone. He's not here. He's not going to show up because he doesn't want to get arrested.
No.
And his wife's divorced him. So he's, you know, essentially cut ties there, right?
Mm-hmm.
Lo and behold, he is found hiding under the home of none other than Mr. Hurt, the Hurt family home.
Really?
Yes. Authorities are called to the home where they find a naked and scraggly Caulfield. He's too weak to do much. He's completely covered in dirt, bugs, you name it.
Mm-hmm.
He was still clinging to the idea that he was this second Messiah, and he had been surviving below the floorboards of the home on the scraps that Mrs. Hurt and the other Brides of Christ had been giving him in secret.
Oh, so they knew.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, the women knew. The women know. Please, women know everything.
Okay.
Mrs. Hurt was committed to an asylum about a month before Caulfield was found under the home. So he had been living off of canned goods and whatever other scraps he could find. So she had not been around to take care of him for about a month when he's found.
Was it like a cellar or something?
It was like the crawl space under the house.
That's it.
Yeah. The authorities spared no time in taking him to Portland to stand before a judge in the matter of his adultery charges.
Was he clothed?
By the time he made it to the judge, yes, he was. While on trial, Edmund Caulfield admitted to the crime he had committed. But he stated that, quote, in the eyes of God, such things were not at all improper in a man of God such as he. They found him guilty after 12 minutes of deliberation. He was asked if he had anything to say after being convicted of the crime of adultery and sentenced to 2 years in state prison. It was reported that he rambled on and on, misquoted some Bible scripture, and then he offered his forgiveness to the judge and the jury members as they, quote, knew not what they did. After serving about 15 months of his 24-month sentence at Oregon State Penitentiary, Caulfield went to California. He spent some time in Los Angeles. And when he realized he couldn't corner the market on religious zealots down there, he moved north to San Francisco. And he just couldn't let the past stay in the past.
Mm-hmm.
And he began to correspond with a devoted member from his group in Corvallis, and that was 17-year-old Esther Mitchell. That would have put Esther around like 15 when all of this religious stuff was going on in Corvallis. After he was incarcerated, she, along with many others, were, again, sent off to insane asylums, the Boys and Girls Society Aid of Oregon. They were sent off because it was just, you know, it was hysteria. These women are hysterical.
Yeah.
And it wasn't that this guy was inciting it. It was these women are hysterical. He shared with Esther that she, and only she, would be the chosen mother of the second Messiah who was coming. But this wasn't good enough. He also sent some harassing letters to his ex-father-in-law, quoting Bible verses and warning him to stay out of his way. But then he also sent some letters to his ex-wife, Maud, who had moved to Seattle at that point to live with his her brother and his new wife. And he asked Maud if they could remarry. And she agreed. She said, if you come up to Seattle, I'll marry you again. Okay. So he did.
So the 3 months wasn't long enough.
No.
Okay.
So He was also able to convince her brother and his wife to sell their property in Seattle to purchase land on the coast of Oregon so that this new Zion could be founded. So this new Garden of Eden for their religious group. He claimed that the new Zion would be the only safe place in the world, as he was about to, quote, call down the wrath of an angry God on these modern Sodoms of Seattle, Portland, San Francisco, and Los Angeles.
Oh.
But especially his friends in Corvallis, Oregon. He cursed the lot of them. Maud and Crayfield were once again remarried, this time by an Orthodox minister in Seattle. Frank Hurt, his wife, and Maud were sent ahead to this new Garden of Eden while the second Messiah would rally the troops, so to speak, and gather his remaining faithful. And in the oddest, maybe most freakishly well-timed of coincidences, the great earthquake that happened in San Francisco hit as Crayfield was traveling to gather his new followers on April 18th in 1906. And when the news of this came out in the newspapers and it was everywhere, he reportedly smiled, but he showed no surprise at it. And he said, quote, I knew that God would respond. And he is quoted as saying that and using this to prove that his teachings, his righteousness was there in what he was saying. So he's claiming that he's responsible for this earthquake in San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
And that if everybody else doesn't fall in line, he's going to do the same in other places. Word spread that the prophet was back in town and his female followers started making their way to flock to his side. It was reported that the train had never seen such an uptake in fares up until that time.
Mm-hmm.
Those that couldn't afford the train fare walked miles and miles, days of hazardous paths to this unpopulated area in Oregon where this land was. Women came from all over in groups or on their own of all ages, and this included the young Esther Mitchell. There were teenagers, young women who had run away from home, women and their children, older women who had left their husbands. They were all just leaving in the middle of the night, some leaving notes before they disappeared for their family members, just saying, I'm going to the prophet and, you know, don't try to stop me.
Yeah.
This is where I'm going. Crayfield continued to speak of his prophecy of the doom of Corvallis and the other towns that had proved to be, you know, inhospitable to his followers. And when the group made their way to the new Zion, a plot of land near Waldport, Oregon, he declared that the sinful city would be destroyed, but it was time to find the chosen woman to carry the second Messiah.
Oh, now it's time.
Right. Never mind, he had already told Esther Mitchell that it was her.
Yeah.
Yeah, but, you know, he didn't want to exclude anybody because what if he made a wrong decision?
Yeah.
So in this great bonfire, the women burned their clothes, whatever belongings they brought, and nakedness again prevailed. And there again was the moaning and the rolling and the praying for hours. That all resumed. And it was just this height of frenzy before everything just came tumbling down. On April 26th, a man from Corvallis was able to find out where Crayfield and the Brides of Christ were now congregating.
Mm-hmm.
This was Lewis Hartley, whose wife and daughter had run off to join the group in Waldport. He decided to make his way down there. He was going to get them back. He was going to put a stop to all this fucking nonsense once and for all. He was just going to handle business.
Yes. Well, in this tomfoolery.
Yes. So he stops along the way to purchase a .32 caliber revolver and a box of bullets. And he arrived in Newport just as this ferry with his wife and daughter on it was pulling away. And wouldn't you know it, of all the luck, who was on that ferry but none other than the new prophet himself? So Hartley quickly took aim, shot at Crayfield 5 times in rapid succession. Nothing happened but a click every time.
Okay.
None of the shots were fired correctly, and Crayfield simply smiled and assured all around him that God protected him and he could not be harmed. Hartley later claimed that the bullets were not the correct type for the gun. Quote, it was the goddamn fool who sold me the cartridges and the gun. The gun is center fire. The cartridges are rim fire. That's why the son of a bitch is still alive. Okay. Yeah. This mishap only fueled the flames of anger for the rest of the men back up in Corvallis. Mm-hmm. It was kind of this rally cry where it was like, you know what? Hartley's on the right path. Let's fucking get this guy.
Yeah.
So groups of men began gathering supplies, guns, ammo. They began making their way to the coast of Oregon to find him. It's kind of unclear if somehow word got to Crayfield or if it had been the plan all along, but Crayfield and Maud left not long after everyone was gathered in the New Zion. There's this report that they stated to the followers they were going to Canada, like British Columbia, to establish a new colony due to them not being welcomed in Waltport.
Okay.
One account is that they were forced to leave the land that Frank Hurt had purchased and to camp out on the beach. Mm-hmm. I really only read that in one place, so I'm not sure if that's correct or if it was just always the plan. They were there temporarily, and then they were going to go to British Columbia. I don't know. The group of men from Corvallis were on the hunt, and some were thinking that Crayfield would again hide in the woods. Mm-hmm. As he had done in the past, but not everyone thought that would be the case. The brother of Esther Mitchell, so his name is George Mitchell, gathered his revolver and ammo. He headed to the train station in Albany, Oregon, hoping to catch Crayfield if he was to travel to Portland or further north. He arrived a day late, and he learned that Crayfield, along with Maud, had made their way on the train to Seattle already.
Okay.
So he waited and he took the next train to be able to follow them up to Seattle. On the morning of May 7th, 1906, George Mitchell was walking the streets of Seattle in search of Edmund Crayfield or his wife, Maud. Mm-hmm. Whether divine intervention or sheer luck, who knows, but he spotted them outside of a convenience store on 1st and Cherry Street. George walked up behind the couple and he quietly put a revolver to the back of Crayfield's head and he pulled the trigger. Edmund Crayfield died instantly. The bullet, quote, entered the back of the neck, breaking the spinal cord at the base of the brain, and then rang around to the right jaw, which it shattered, end quote. There was quite a mass hysteria, mm-hmm. right? As you would imagine, somebody just being shot casually on the street. Seattle's not a quiet town, even at this time. It was probably pretty populated. Maud was hysterical. She was claiming that her husband would rise again, like Christ had on the third day, so she didn't want his body to be buried. Mm-hmm. Mitchell just stood by. He was happy with the end result. He stayed with his gun in his hand, and he calmly waited for the police to arrive, and then he handed over the gun, didn't protest going. He just matter-of-factly agreed to go, and he was like, yep, I did it. Let's go get this taken care of. So he was taken into custody to await trial, and while at the police station, was able to send a telegram to Maud's father in Corvallis reading, quote, I got my man and am in jail here.
Am in jail.
Well, you know, you paid by the letter.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Franz Edmund Crayfield was buried in the Lakeview Cemetery on May 9th with only Maud at the site to mourn him. He did not, in fact, rise again from the dead as the second Christ.
No, I was rooting for him.
I know. But the story doesn't end there. As you would expect, George Mitchell was held on murder charges, mm-hmm. of course. He was placed on trial in King County Court. It was no doubt the most spectacular event of the time at this point.
Yeah.
Witnesses were called in on what had taken place while all of the women were under Crayfield's control. There was testimony from several people describing the quote-unquote free love that was taking place at the meetings. Mm-hmm. The mental state of some of the girls and women who were sent to live in asylums or the Oregon Boys and Girls Aid Society. The details were well beyond what societal norms would allow anyone's sensibilities to process in that day and age. But the women were not to be blamed, as they were too fragile to know what Crayfield was preaching was wrong.
Okay.
Yeah. George Mitchell was hailed as some sort of hero for ridding the world of this prophet. Esther Mitchell, who was a devoted follower of Crayfield and George's sister, reportedly sat stone-faced and emotionless throughout the entire trial. When questioned as to the crime, reportedly George said, Quote, I came to Seattle to kill this man who ruined my sister. I completed my job, end quote. On July 10th, the jury deemed that George Mitchell was not guilty and he was acquitted of all charges.
Huh.
Yeah. I think that's quite interesting. Therein lies the problem with the judicial system back then. It was based off of morality and not facts. This man committed murder.
Yeah.
He should have been
convicted
of murder.
And he was like, yep, I did it. Let's get this done.
Caught with the gun in his hand.
Yeah.
Freely admitted.
Tons of witnesses.
Yeah. So whether you agree with why he did it or not, there was no reason for you to do that other than you didn't agree with his beliefs. Yeah. I don't feel that that's justice, you know?
It's not, but...
Whatever. What's done is done. Esther had remained calm and motionless, like I said, while her brother was on trial. When asked, you know, about this later on, she really has no response, I guess you would say. So with all of this excitement coming to a close, the Mitchell family, the newly acquitted George and two of his brothers and Esther included, made plans to go home to Corvallis. And by all accounts from her brothers, she was willingly going with them on this train to Portland. As the family made their way to board the train, Esther pulled out a pearl-handled revolver, brought it to the back of George's head, and pulled the trigger, killing him instantly. Just as he had killed Crayfield, she had killed him. Her brothers never saw it coming. They could not react quick enough to prevent it, and she was immediately placed in custody and taken to the police station to be held. And she, again, had no emotion. When asked why she had done this, she claimed that she and Maud had planned this in the eventuality that George would be acquitted of Crayfield's murder. Maud was then brought in, and she was held as well as an accomplice. She corroborated Esther's story, stating she had purchased the gun, but that it was agreed upon that Esther would pull the trigger. Both women were tried on murder charges, both completely admitting to the crime. Maud would be found dead in her jail cell before the end of the trial. She took her own life by way of strychnine poisoning.
How'd she get that?
Who knows? Esther was found to be not guilty by reason of insanity. And she was sent to stay at Western State Hospital in Steilacoom in Washington. She resided there until her paroled release in April of 1909.
That's not that long.
Mm-mm. There were some very wild accusations about her in the local papers after she was released. One story was that she ran away before she was officially paroled.
Uh-huh.
And the asylum didn't know where she was, so they didn't get in trouble, basically to keep it all hush-hush. They said that she had been paroled already,
mm-hmm.
but the parole apparently was still in the works in this story. So they're saying that they were like, oh, yeah, she was paroled. She didn't leave before she was paroled. It was fine. It was all fine.
Yeah.
That was one accounting of it. Another was that she was such a loose and wanton woman that she had run off with Chinese people and had a, quote, love of the poppy flower.
Oh, okay.
And that's where I'm like, this is just, that's so exaggerated.
Yeah.
But there was so many stories of this in local newspapers that it just was circulated that that's what happened. And it really doesn't surprise me, but it does surprise me that people are just so gullible that they just believe everything that's in writing.
Yeah.
In reality, she was paroled officially, and she was living with Mr. and Mrs. Hurt in Corvallis. She had been given to them in custody while she was on parole from the Washington State Hospital.
Okay.
Esther would go on to get married to a local man by the name of James Barry in Waldport on April 9th in 1914. Unfortunately, by August of the same year, she took her own life with strychnine poisoning, the same way that Maud had done the years prior. She was not able to mentally or emotionally recover from mm-hmm. being involved with the Brides of Christ and didn't get over Crayfield's murder by her brother. She was only 26 years old at the time of her death.
Good.
Yeah, It was very sad.
Well, that was old for them.
I mean, yes, but you got to think, like, 15 years old, she's caught up in this huge religious movement and just really never recovered from it.
Yeah.
Many of the women involved in the religious movement were never the same. Many of them were, like I said, sent to asylums multiple times. They had a hard time resuming their daily lives when they came out. And I'm completely fascinated by how all of this happened. And I think there's a lot of research that people have put into looking at, like, the psychology of this type of case.
Yeah.
Something that I read in all of this stood out to me, and I found this in an essay written by, I think her name is Sophie Coe. It's hosted, this essay that she wrote is hosted on the Portland State University Library website. And I think it sums up kind of the feeling of like what was happening at this time for these women. So, quote, many of the young women that joined came from broken families in tough or boring lives. All of these followers seemed to be looking for security, a sense of belonging, and perhaps freedom from the strictures of prim and proper Victorian society. There were a multitude of circumstances throughout the group that gave Creffield the opportunity to convince them of his religion, which is why he chose Corvallis as his target in the first place. Along with their specific past, Corvallis was described as a boring town with a curfew at 9 o'clock. As a socially restricted gender living in a dull town while their husbands were gone farming all day, it's clear why Creffield's female followers wanted to break out of their social confines.
Yeah.
This group was easy to persuade, and they surely had no hesitation to call Creffield their leader, end quote. We could go on and on and on and talk about why do you think this and why do you think that. I think that really summed it up, honestly.
Yeah, just the mundane life, and someone gave them a chance and out, basically, and they took it.
Right. And this was a time when, females were held to a very strict standard.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and you didn't have opinions that were not your own. You weren't supposed to.
Mm-hmm.
There was no progressive thinking going on in a small community like this, I'm sure.
No.
So, yeah, no wonder he came in and just it was spellbinding for these women.
Yeah.
And, you know, for even for some of these men who continued to help him with things. So it's definitely.
Yeah. I think it was both like the boring, mundane town, but also how charismatic he was.
Well, yeah, he wouldn't have gotten anywhere if he didn't have a presence about him.
Yeah.
So that's the story of the Brides of Christ from Corvallis. There's a lot of local historians that have done research on this topic.
Yeah.
And I'm going to link to a couple of books, and I think there's even like a movie. I didn't watch the movie.
It would be a great Lifetime movie.
Oh my God. Can you imagine that as a Lifetime afternoon movie?
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Or one of those after school specials.
Yeah.
The Brides of Christ. Yeah. If ever you would look at a picture and you would be like, yeah, that guy is fucking absolutely bonkers. This guy's photo at some point when he is at the penitentiary.
Yeah.
He looks just wild. Like his eyes are just, yeah. He could have been, like, I equate that to like looking at a Manson photo.
Yeah, I was going to say, does he have those come at me bro eyes?
He does. And he's like smirking. He's like smirking in this photo. It's, and you know, that took a lot. Because the like photography of the time is different. It wasn't like just an instant snapshot. Like you had to hold still for a couple of seconds.
Yeah.
So the fact that this is what his photo looks like from jail is, yeah, he put effort into that.
it was premeditated.
It was. But that's definitely the vibe that I would get from him.
Yeah.
It's just that sociopathic, psychotic.
Oh yeah, most definitely.
Yeah. It's something for sure. So yeah, That's the story of Franz Edmund Crayfield.
Just that the Brides of Christ sound like the next Quentin Tarantino movie.
Yeah.
It does.
Okay. I could see him doing something with that.
No, just that's what it sounds like.
Yeah. I could see it. I could. All right. Well, thank you, everyone, for joining us on this wild ride today. We appreciate all of your support. We will be back in 2 weeks to bring you another fascinating case. Until we meet again, campers, stay safe and stay out of the damn woods.
Stay out of the woods.
Especially if there's a religious fanatic in there.
Nah.
Bye.
Bye.